Only the last week.
After all this time?
After all this time, that's right. Well, I want to start with a quick review. So if you guys can all see the board, I think I figured out the dynamic with our graphic. For those of us who are visiting us today, our graphic started very small and wonderfully elegant because we only had two or three words. But we are now on to our 12th word. And anything with 12 elements other than a clock face is really hard for me to organize. So,
12-step program.
That's right, a 12-step program. That I could do, I'm sure.
You have to do the survey.
Oh, I do.
Yeah, but we'll do the survey or we'll have time for that at the end. We start with the idea of Adam and Eve, who start in perfection, don't they? They have perfect faith, they have perfect holiness, and they're made in the image of God. Now, we've talked a little bit about that. Being made in the image of God means they have three characteristics that we have too, but that can get us in trouble. Do you remember what they are?
Without sin.
Okay, being made in the image of God means without sin, but that doesn't get them in trouble necessarily, right?
Free will.
They have free will, absolutely. What else do they have that we have too?
Intelligence.
Theoretically speaking. And the last ingredient to remember? Emotion. So, being created in God's image means having free will, intelligence, and emotion. Okay? And those three things, it turns out, can trip you up sometimes. And so they do. Adam and Eve fall into sin, and they lose this state of perfect faith and holiness. Right? Now, we said in the early part of the course that mercy, love, and grace, those tell us about God. What do they tell us about God, or what part of God do those describe? Do we remember? It was a long time ago now.
Oh, how much he loves us.
That's right. It's his state, his mental state, right? So these are God's motives. Okay? His mercy, his love, and his grace. And he's motivated because he loves us so much. And do we remember what kind of a love that is and how it differs from human love?
It'll never end.
It'll never end. It is 100% devoted. Human love typically has some sort of quid pro quo, right? You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. There's a 50-50 quality to it, okay? And, you know, in a bad week, maybe it becomes a 70-30 one way, but then another week it'll be 30-70, and so it all evens out in the end. But God's love is total and complete devotion and is eternal. It lasts forever, okay? He has mercy for us. And do you remember what mercy means? It's two things. Feeling sorry for someone
and doing something about it.
And then doing something, right? So to show mercy means, yes, I take pity or I feel sorry or I feel bad, but I'm also going to do something about it. If I just feel bad by itself, I'm really not showing any mercy. Mercy means doing something, okay? And as a result of these, he grants us grace. Do you remember what grace, what our definition is?
Undeserved love. Yeah.
Undeserved love, right? So these are God's motives. These are the ways that God is working. Now, the circle, atonement and redemption. We talked about the atonement cover, and we talked about, you know, those wonderful Indiana Jones movies. The Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? And what did you have to sprinkle on the atonement cover?
Blood.
The blood of the sacrifice, right? So blood was central to the action of the sacrifice and central to the action of becoming reconciled with God or being protected from God, actually, right? Because we talked about Aaron going into the Holy of Holies with the rope around his leg, remember? So if something went wrong, they could pull out whatever was left. Okay?
Yeah.
Well, I just have the feeling that if something goes wrong, it's a bad thing, right? You know, and hopefully they could get him out while he's still, you know, alive, but maybe not.
Well, a smoldering rope.
That's right. So, atonement means that there's a sacrifice involved. And we have Pastor Waterstrat's wonderful definition. Atonement, if you say it differently, right? Sounds like what?
At one-ment.
At one with God. God reconciling us to him. And we have the idea of redemption. Okay? How do we get redeemed? What happens? I think it's the trickiest word we have had.
You're being bought back?
Yes, being bought back, right? Or being protected, right? To be redeemed. Now, this is circled because this is God's actions. And all of these actions take place in the same person who is also God. Right? And so what name am I going to put up here?
Jesus.
Yeah.
So God understands this problem, and he's motivated to do something about it. Jesus is what he does about it, right? Now the results of this, we are justified, right? Holy and righteous. What do these phrases really mean? What does it mean to be justified, holy, and righteous?
We can be in God's presence again.
Yes. We can be in God's presence again. Okay? Now, we talked a little bit about justification and to be justified, right? And in the common use of the word, it means I have a reason for doing what I'm doing, right? I'm justified. Okay? But in religious parlance, it's a little different. Okay? To be justified means to be declared something. To be declared what?
Innocent.
Innocent. That's right. And we can declare each other innocent all we want, and maybe we'll make each other feel really good that way. However, whose declaration of innocence is the one that matters the most?
God's.
God's, right? So when God justifies us as a result of Jesus' action, we achieve holiness, which we lost, right? Mm-hmm. We achieve righteousness. We are now right with God, if you want to think of it that way, which Adam and Eve were, but they lost. Okay? And all of this, we worked with hope last week. All of this gives us hope. Right? So hope is a result of this whole process, if you want to think of it that way. And another way of thinking about this is as a restoration. Adam and Eve started in perfect faith and holiness. We, when we get there to heaven, what will we have? Perfect faith and holiness. So there's a restoration sort of thing going on here. And that's a nice review. And can you tell our review is getting longer and longer each week? We would have to make the class longer if we went further. Okay? So Adam and Eve go from a state of perfect faith and holiness to sin. God solves this problem, right? And God's results accrue to us, to our benefit, and he restores this state of perfect faith and holiness. There we go. Well, that brings us to this week's word. Now, this week's word describes what happens for us when we understand how God is working. I was about to say, when we understand the diagram, but it's really not the diagram. We understand how God is working. So let's take a look at the word peace. Now we're going to start with our little riddle from last week, right? And we had a riddle about hope. Okay? Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 13:13, and now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. Okay, having studied all three of these little big words, why is love the greatest of the three? What?
I'm just going to say that because without love, you don't have any of those.
Right. Love, as we see, is God's motivations. Is one of God's motivations. And grace is undeserved love, right? And mercy are actions motivated by love. So first, love is kind of the foundation to all of this. In a way, love is the antidote to sin. God's love, that is an antidote to sin. Okay? So that's one reason. Pastor Carr gives us a second reason. And what he writes is this. Love is the greatest because it is the only one that remains in eternity. In eternity, you don't need to trust in the unseen and yet promised because all promises will be made good on. Hope is also something based on a promise for the future. Hope and faith will be replaced with sight and constant experience of God's goodness. So love will be eternal. But these others, right? Hope, when we're in heaven, we won't need that anymore, right? And so Pastor Carr reasons that love is the eternal one. Well, now let's talk a little bit about peace and work through what we have today, because we have a lot of passages to look at. Our first task is going to be looking up the following Bible sections to determine what is described as the opposite of peace. Sometimes we can best understand what a word means by looking at its antonym, by its opposite. So, if we could go around the word, Mark, or around the room, Mark, if you could start us with Leviticus 26:6.
I will grant peace in the land, and you will lie down, and no one will make you afraid. I will remove savage beasts from the land, and the sword will not pass through your country.
Okay. So now, what are the opposites of peace that are listed here for us in Leviticus?
Fear.
Fear is one, right?
Sword?
Yeah, the sword. The sword is a wonderful symbol of warfare, right? I've often thought about, you know, if we lived in a society where firearms had never been invented, how different our lives would be. It's, you know, the taking of another life is so easy with a firearm, and so difficult with a sword or a spear or something like that. Very, very different times. I'm always struck by that reading Old Testament stories especially. You know, how sort of physically violent things had to become or were. Okay? There's one other phrase here that I think is really interesting. What about the savage beasts?
The devil as a roaring lion walketh about.
There we go. The devil as the roaring lion. Good morning, Hal. Come on.
Good morning. Sorry.
Whoops. Oh, that's all right. Okay. The devil is a roaring lion. The notion of savage beasts, or more broadly speaking, the notion just of predators, right? And it's very interesting because, you know, that's a word that has come to mean something very different. If you guys have been reading the paper this week, right? We had a sexual predator who abducted a child, and 18 years later, right? They found the child, and they found him, and so on and so forth. But that notion of predation or predatory behavior, you know, that's another interesting opposite to peace, right? In peace, you're not going to worry about predators. A few years back, I lived in the same neighborhood as Pastor Carr, the Bird Streets over there by Del Campo High School, and they had a report of a mountain lion, okay, sighted somewhere in that neighborhood. And I, being, you know, a skeptical person, said, oh, please. But as I walked around in the evening, I kept looking in the trees, right? And there was a little bit of anxiety, right? And the county of Sacramento did what the county always does. They put up a sign, and the sign said, watch out for the mountain lion, okay? To solve that problem. So anyway, well, let's go on to Ecclesiastes 3:8.
A time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace.
Okay, so the opposite here of peace is what? Is war, right? And we have these rhyming of ideas, right, which we often see in the Old Testament. Well, let's go on to 1 Samuel 1:12 through 17.
As she kept on praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth.
Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk.
And he said to her, how long will you keep on getting drunk? Get rid of your wine. Not so, my lord, Hannah replied. I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I have not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord.
Do not take your servant for a wicked woman. I have been praying here out of my great anguish and grief.
Eli answered, go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him.
Okay. Now, Eli tells her to go in peace. She's clearly not in peace. What state is she in?
Turmoil.
Anguish and turmoil, right? So she's having a meltdown. And she's saying, okay, I can't solve this problem on my own anymore. And I must pray and ask for God's help to solve it. So the opposite of peace we see in Samuel is anguish, great anguish. We're being deeply troubled, okay? Being aware, perhaps, of this part of our diagram, right? Because if you don't know the rest of it, you can recognize that you're sinful, right? And in the modern era, right, what we would say is, hey, I never did anything wrong. When in fact the truth is, we haven't stopped doing things wrong. That's really more like it, right? It's we, it's not just I. Okay? Well, let's go on to 1 Corinthians 14:33.
For God is not a God of disorder, but of peace, as in all the congregations of the saints.
Okay. So what's the opposite of peace here?
Disorder.
Now that's a very interesting thing, isn't it? And I think about my children's bedrooms, which are so disorderly.
Good example.
Right? And they have the ability to not see it. They're better at not seeing it than I am at yelling at them about it most of the time. But the notion of order, orderliness, right? When things are in chaos, it generates anxiety, right? you can become troubled because your surroundings are so jumbled and, you know, impossible to work with. Yeah.
So if we're very orderly parents, our children are going to be the opposite of that. They're going to be like that, or if we're disorderly.
I don't know. I think there's got to be some law.
I think it's just that, you know, yeah. It just doesn't matter to them.
That's right. And then, when I say they don't see it, well, maybe.
No, they don't.
No, they just don't agree.
Don't kid yourself.
Yeah.
I'm very orderly, and I have two that are very orderly, and I've got one that is just total unorderly.
Yes.
I mean, and it doesn't bother her in the least.
Right, and people have different yeah. tolerances. Yes, yeah. That's what they have, tolerances mm-hmm. for levels of disorder. My tolerance is very low, you know? And unfortunately, I work in a classroom where I can impose my tolerance, okay. my lack of tolerance, every day, or 180 days a year at least, you know? And at home, forget about it. It's just not going to happen. But the notion of order, right, which for me calms me down, you know? And I think for a lot of folks, not for everyone, but certainly for me. Okay, so a candle shines even brighter when it's lit in the darkness. The same is true for peace. Relate a personal experience where the experience of peace followed things like fear, war, emotional anguish, and disorder in your life. Okay, so let's think about this. Where that experience of peace came after a period of fear or anguish or disorder.
When my boys clean up their rooms, I just have this feeling of peace. Or just clutter around the house.
Uh-huh.
Violent turbulence on an airplane.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Right? That notion of disorder for a moment, right? Which we all, you know, terrible thoughts flash through our minds. Mark?
I'd say, like, probably the feeling most people got right after 9/11.
Yes. Yeah. And the notion that the order of really the world had
yep.
changed somehow, you know, on that particular day. That's
yeah.
right.
Okay. I think when you go to the doctor, you have a test, and he says, well, it might be.
Oh, yeah.
And then we can't take another test for another month or whatever. So that whole time, it's until you find out what it is.
That's right.
So you
and
can deal with it.
Right. And that's one of those experiences that really teaches you the value of prayer. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's when you really learn that prayer under those circumstances restores order and restores peace. It is magic, right? Or feels that way. This notion of order being restored and leaving the anguish behind, the more I think about it, at least in my life, when those things have happened, they've happened because I've admitted to myself that I can't solve this. Right? It's not mine to solve. You know, God can solve it, right? God can give me the things I need to get through it one way or another, but left to myself, it just can't happen. And it's odd because that sense of helplessness is the kind of the flip side of that sense of peace. You know, and I don't know how else to explain it, but it's one of those wonderful and enduring mysteries, at least for me and in my prayer life.
A girlfriend made me a little plaque that says, every night I'm going to hand all my worries over to the Lord because he's going to be up all night anyway.
That's wonderful.
Like that.
That's wonderful. Well, let's go on to the definitions of peace. The first is a word that we all heard before, shalom, right? And this is translated as the idea of wholeness. You're healthy, safe, well. Nothing is missing. Nothing is lacking. The second word, eirene, to the Greek mind, this is the Greek definition, peace is a brief interlude in what is otherwise a constant state of war. It is the palpable opposite of war. So that interlude between wars, that's what peace means. Now it's interesting, you know, because I'm a teacher of history, and when you look at history, it is often written as though, you know, you've got this long period of time punctuated by wars, and these periods of non-war in which all sorts of things take place. And I think, you know, the Greek definition comes closer to the way history courses are taught, right? But I think for a Christian, you know, this notion of wholeness, that which was lost, right, being restored, that seems more in line with peace. Both meanings are really interesting. Okay, we know that Jesus was the Prince of Peace, promised by Isaiah. How do we reconcile that fact with Jesus' words in Matthew 10:34? So we need someone to read wherever we are, Matthew 10:34.
Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword.
Okay. Okay? Now, how can Jesus, who's going to bring peace, right? How does the sword reference work?
He needs to defeat the devil.
Well, he needs to defeat the devil, okay? But if we, you know, what we know about Jesus is that defeating the devil is not going to be difficult for him. He's going to bring a sword. Now, Mark, what do you think?
This is just a guess here, but I know that he also, there's Judgment Day too.
You bet. Okay, so there's going to be a day of judgment upon which those who are not smart enough to cower in fear behind Jesus and say, you know, God, I got some complaints. The way you organize the world, you know, this just doesn't, who thought of this? Was this your idea? That guy is going to be in trouble. Okay, I'm not going to be that guy.
Yeah.
Right? What else? Let's think of the context here. Yes?
Well, I was thinking of the verse where Jesus says, father will be against son and daughter mm-hmm. will be against mother.
Mm-hmm.
But there's going to be constant strife because we're still in this world.
That's right. And because we're still in this world, in our role as Christians, we will come up, you know, in our society, we are so remarkably lucky, right? Christians in our society do not get fed to lions or burned at the stake. But when you look throughout history, that's been the price of faith for so many millions of people over the centuries. So for us, this notion of Jesus bringing the sword, it's hard for us to see this in its literal sense, but in history it has been literally true. And the notion that if you're going to stand up for the truth, people are not going to be happy with you, right? You're going to have to fight for that from time to time. You're going to have to lose some friends. Maybe some family members. So now we have a hard thing, don't we? We have to reconcile this idea of peace with this idea of the conflict that will be the result of the way we live, the way we practice our faith. How do we reconcile those two? How can we still be at peace knowing that our faith may cause others to shun us, may cause others to leave us?
Greater reward.
Mm-hmm.
Losing a friend or a relative over religious matters is painful, but
yeah.
There's a bigger pain if you don't.
Absolutely. Okay. The eternal reward, the restoration of these things, perfect faith and holiness, this gives me a wonderfully enduring sense of peace. When I understand this, I don't have to worry anymore. I really don't. And to be free from that worry, yes, to the outside world, I'm going to generate some controversy, no doubt about it. I'm going to lose some friends, and I have in the last few years. You know. And of course, I think back to what my parents used to tell me, which was, well, if you lost your friends over something like this, were they ever really friends? And if they weren't, what have you really lost? Those sorts of questions come to mind. Right? So there's an internal state of peace and wholeness, which we have as Christians, which is going to be, the external world is not going to go along with that. That's just how it is. Right? I wish it were not so, but that's how it is. And we always have to remember that it's easier for us than for Christians in many other parts of the world. Okay? Well, let's go on to the next page. And where are we? We are at peace, the ultimate result of the big words. Okay? And we're looking now at Colossians 1:19 through 23, which combines both the idea of wholeness and the lack of war. So as we read the section, we're going to answer some questions. What was lacking and how is it provided? And who was at war? And how did the war cease? So if we could pick it up wherever we were.
For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in heaven.
And through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross.
Once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior.
But now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body present your whole, holy in his sight without blemish and free from accusation.
If you continue in your faith, established and firm, not moved from the hope held out in the gospel, this is the gospel that you heard, and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, have become a servant.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, so when we think about our two senses of the term peace, the first one is wholeness and restoration. In our excerpt from Colossians here, what gets restored? What's whole now that wasn't before?
Our relationship with God.
Yeah, our relationship with God is restored, right? And we are presented to Him. You know, if you look at, I think it's verse 22, we will be presented holy in His sight, without blemish, and free from accusation. So, this perfect holiness will be restored, become whole again, right? But there's also a Greek sense of peace here as well. So for this one, the second question is, who was at war and how did the war cease? What do we see? What do we think? I'm not sure it's specifically stated in this passage or not.
We're at war.
Mm-hmm.
With our sin.
That's right. We certainly are. If you look at verse 21, once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior, being alienated from God, being at war with God, how smart does that sound? That sounds pretty dumb, okay? And this notion of the old Adam and the new man at war within us, you know, even now. And so that notion of strife and conflict and warfare, and peace being the ending of all that, right? So both our Greek and our Roman sense of the word are here in this passage from Colossians. Well, let's take a look at Romans 5, 1 through 2. Now, we studied this chapter in depth before. We're going to review the big Bible words contained and describe how peace is the main point and ultimate result of every big word we've studied. So if we take a look at the excerpt from Romans, the verses from Romans, I can reorganize my stuff so the wind doesn't take it away. So wherever we are.
Therefore, since we have been justified through faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ.
Through whom we have gained access by faith into His grace in which we now stand, and we rejoice in the hope of the glory of God.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, now we've got a whole bunch of our words in here, don't we? So in the first verse, since we have been justified through faith, we can look on the board. Justification, right? We've been justified because of our faith. And our faith in Jesus, but faith in Jesus includes the whole board, right? Okay. So that's the first bit of good news and the first word that we see. We have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. So peace with God, right? We can see it both ways, can't we? We've been restored, so we are whole again. Okay. But we're also no longer struggling. We're no longer at war with God. We're no longer trying to make the choice between what Satan has to offer. And remember what Satan offers Christ, right? When he tempts Christ?
Yeah.
All the wealth of the world, right? The whole enchilada, all of the cities, all of the everything offers him everything. Okay, and in a way, we're facing that same choice every day too, aren't we? We may not be offered everything, you know, unless you watch Super Bowl commercials, in which case you are offered everything, right?
Yeah.
Really, too often too. I mean, the Super Bowl takes way too long. Okay, so anyway, so Christ is tempted to be offered everything, and we face similar temptations. Okay. We're also taking a look at the sentence itself. Because if you take out all of those, I think they're prepositional phrases, all those modifying phrases, we have very, very simple language here. Because if you take a look at the first verse 1, okay, therefore, since we have been justified through faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have gained access by faith into this grace in which we now stand. Now, if we take away the phrases that start with since, okay, and through, and by, and in, if you take away all those phrases, what have we got left over? Therefore, it gets real short. We have peace with God. Right? So the result, grammatically, and the way this is translated, is we have peace with God. That's, if you were diagramming this sentence, that's what the sentence would be, right? We have peace down below with God. That's it. And in the second verse, right? And we rejoice, but now we have another prepositional phrase, right? In the hope. So we have peace with God and we rejoice. Okay? Which sounds like pretty sensible stuff to do, right? That's pretty happy. Now the rest of those prepositional phrases are really indicating a lot of this process on the board, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's happening through Jesus, through God's actions, okay? And we stand in the grace of God. Now, Pastor Carr and I were discussing that the image of that, you know, and when he was in seminary, he shared with me that one of his professors talked about the notion of God's grace as a shower. But the shower follows you wherever you go, right? So you're showered in God's grace, okay? And you have all that wonderful feeling that you have in the shower. Personally, I have my best ideas in the shower, though I seldom remember them. I know they're really great. That's one idea. Another idea is the idea of an umbrella, right? Which protects you from God's wrath, which is happening all around you. So this notion of protection and divine sort of a canopy of some kind for us. You know, that was the idea that he thought about, okay, or that was taught to him. You know, and for me, I tend to think of it more as a tunnel or a light at the end of the tunnel. You know, when you're in a tunnel, you can be kind of scared. It can be sad and dark and lonely. But if you can see the light at the end of the tunnel and focus on that, you know, you can calm down and you can make it through and everything will be okay, right? So I don't know. There are lots of images for this. In both cases, whether you're in the shower or under an umbrella or focusing on the light at the end of the tunnel, you should be feeling at peace. Because you can see around you, right, that things may be crazy, chaotic, disorderly, warlike, but not within, and not when it comes to the biggest and most important questions. Okay? Well, let's see if we can keep moving, because I've got to give you guys a few minutes to do the evaluation at the end. And so we finished with Romans 5, 1 through 2. And then we have the verse from Isaiah. Now, do you guys have this verse from Isaiah 53:5?
Yes.
You do, okay. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. And by his wounds, we are healed. Right? Now, that's an unbelievable verse for me. And the thing that makes it more unbelievable than anything else is that it was written hundreds of years before Christ. And I sometimes ask myself, okay, Isaiah is saying these things, and I'm wondering what he is constructing of it. God is speaking to humanity through Isaiah, and he knows enough to know that this is from God, but he can't quite know, in the temporal sense, exactly what it means right now, right? But he has faith to know that it'll mean something later on.
That's because it wasn't his own interpretation.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It was God-inspired words through the Holy Spirit, not subject to a human's interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think of myself, if I had said this, I would want to know what this means. I would say, God, what does it mean?
Wow, this is good, but what's it mean? Especially,
yeah.
This was in one of the meditations earlier this week, reading, and we've heard it so many times, but for some reason it just stuck in my brain that those last couple of words, by his wounds we are healed.
Yeah.
I mean, think logically. If I'm wounded, how could you be healed by that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which just makes it all more miraculous.
That's right. And the fact that it doesn't make sense doesn't worry me.
Yeah.
In a way it would have. 10 years ago, mm-hmm. that would have worried me. That would have meant, okay, if I can't embrace this intellectually, mm-hmm. you know, I'm out, mm-hmm. right? And I no longer feel that. And that's a wonderful feeling, to know that that faith can grow over time. I really love that. Yes, Mark.
Another interesting thing, when I read this again, Isaiah says, but he was pierced for our transgressions.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't say, he will be.
Yes. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm.
But it hadn't happened yet. He's still saying he was, which again, like we talk about so often, it makes no sense.
Right. And the only way we can try to reconcile it is to think of God as outside of time.
Yep.
You know?
Exactly.
God has the ultimate time travel machine, right? Whatever it is. And so we're stuck here in a temporal reality. God is not. And Isaiah maybe realizes this. I don't know. You know, I'll get to ask him someday, I hope. Mm-hmm. So. All right, so peace as the result in our lives. Let's take a look at our verses here. The first one is going to be Ephesians 6:15. How does the gospel give us readiness? So, who's next for reading? Okay.
And with your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace.
Okay.
Did you want to go on?
No, let's take this one for a minute.
This is in the context of the armor of God, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, that's right. Okay. So feet fitted with the readiness. Okay. This is one of these times when I think of some literal things, right? There are occasionally it happens that I need to walk across my lawn to get the newspaper in the morning and I have no shoes on, right? I really get upset about it. I'd say, I'm going to call the newspaper company. I'm going to complain about this newspaper delivery person because this is totally unreasonable. Right? My feet are so delicate that walking across a wet lawn, okay, is torture. And I think there is a connection with our sense of well-being and with the state of our feet. Right?
Absolutely.
And so the notion of protecting our feet or equipping our feet to do, I don't know, good works or to be involved in a sport or something else, I think there's a real direct connection there, you know, just on a physiological level that we get. So we're going to be fitted with sandals, maybe, okay, because fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace, we're going to be protected. Our feet are going to be okay. We're going to be able to go where we need to go and do what we need to do, right? That's the meaning that I take from it. Any other ideas for Ephesians 6:15?
The idea that popped in my head was about being ready to give an answer.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if that's right, but that's just what popped into my head.
That's right, and readiness, right, which is in place of both or in both of those verses, mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty good idea. Right? And be able to give an explanation. And to give an answer for cheerfulness. You know, I'm finding that that's a pretty important thing. You know, when stuff goes wrong and people who happen to be devout Christians don't go all to pieces, other people will wonder why. They really, really will, right? And you have to be ready to give that answer. Well, let's go on to Philippians 4:7.
And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus.
Yeah. Well, let's think of that peace of God. I mean, I would say, hey, look, I just did a diagram. I understand it perfectly. Right? But if I really believe that, then I'm not understanding God anymore. Right? Satan is telling me what a great guy I am, and I'm falling for it. Okay? So that peace of God which transcends, right, all understanding, transcends. What does that mean?
It's beyond your understanding.
It's beyond. It rises above.
Right.
Yes, you can make all the nifty charts you want, right? And you can even know that what God is doing is good and holy and saving for us. We can even know those things. But to understand the idea completely, it transcends our understanding. It's a matter of faith, just to believe in it, right? And it goes on in the second, which says, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Now, guard is an interesting verb. Guard from whom or from what?
From ourselves.
Yes. From ourselves, right? From our old Adam, from the sin into which we were born. So we need to be guarded, and God's peace will do that. God's peace, which transcends our understanding, will protect us from our worst instincts, from our nature itself. Well, what do we have next? I think we have, is it the Colossians? Colossians 3:15?
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, since as members of one body, you were called to peace, and be thankful.
Okay, the peace of Christ. Now that's maybe a different peace.
Yeah, it's the shalom.
That's right. That's shalom. Mm-hmm. Right? Let the wholeness that you have achieved, or let the wholeness that God has given you, right, be in your hearts. knowing that we started with it, and this whole rigmarole had to happen, and it's going to be restored. Because God, in the end, is a God of love. He's also a God of stern commandments, and we can't ignore that. But because of God's love, this problem is not really a problem. Other thoughts on Colossians 3:15? Here, I should look up what Pastor Carr has said about this one, too. This side. Okay. Now, Pastor Carr's question here is, what are the practical ways that we let peace rule in our hearts? Okay. That's a good question. Before you read you his answer, I want to hear yours. What are the practical ways that we let peace rule in our hearts? What do we do?
Well, it says be thankful.
Yes. We're thankful. We appreciate the fact, appreciate just how lucky we are. You know? Any history teacher can talk to you ad nauseum about that, right? So we're remarkably fortunate. And where do we express that thanks?
In our words and actions.
In our words, our actions, hopefully to each other and to everyone, but also, I think, specifically of prayer.
Yeah.
Right? And that notion of being thankful, boy, is that hard to be sometimes. But that idea of being thankful in prayer and also in the way we interact with others. Pastor Carr, you know, gives us his response, which is, life is a commotion of distractions and drama. Anybody with teenagers in your past or in the house now, as I have three teenagers, it's drama all the time. Okay? Rather than get carried away, we keep our eyes and chins up and remember the big picture. Standard advice to chronic worriers is, if it doesn't matter in 5 years, stop worrying about it. For a Christian, if it doesn't matter in the new heaven and the new earth, in eternity, stop worrying about it. Right? This notion of the bigger picture, the perspective that Christians have. Very reassuring, very peace-giving, okay? And I've decided that, as we get older, our parents become geniuses, right? And I remember my father never being terribly upset about the teenage drama in his house, where he had four teenagers at one time, you know? And I tried to impress him, this is important. He says, is it? Why? Why is this important? Shut up! You know, and then I'd run around and because the drama is not about the drama, it's about the kid, right? It's a way to suck all the attention in the house just to that one person and so forth. So anyway, well, let's go on to Isaiah 32:17. And, Pastor has written, peace is pictured as a fruit here. What is it about righteousness, as we've studied it, that produces peace, which Isaiah describes here so beautifully as a quiet confidence? So,
righteousness will be peace. The effect of righteousness will be quietness and confidence forever.
Very good. And that's another beautiful verse. And we see again the notion of Hebrew poetry where ideas are being rhymed rather than words. So the fruit of righteousness will be peace. Now, righteousness is one of our earlier words, becoming right with God. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, when you say the fruit of righteousness, how would we translate that? What is the fruit of something?
Result.
The result. Yeah. The outcome, right? So the result of righteousness will be peace. Okay? And then it tells us that peace, right, the effect of righteousness will be quietness and confidence forever. Now that's interesting. Is there a relationship between peace and quietness?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Calm.
Absolutely. Quietness, calm. Okay? The idea of just slowing the world down a bit. Just relaxing. Listening to the breeze. Listening to the wind, right? When we're on a camping trip, that's one of my very favorite things to do.
Trees.
Yeah. To get away or wake up early in the morning, get out of the tent, and just listen, you know, to the wind and the trees, or whatever happens to be going on, if we're near, you know, a brook, listening to the brook, and so on and so forth. So that sense of quietness is very important. And the other part, confidence. That's a word that we've seen. It's popped into several of our discussions over the course, right? What is it that Christians have to be confident about?
That we're saved.
Yes. That we're saved. That in the biggest picture, the picture that matters the most, we really have nothing to worry about.
No.
Okay? And even as I say those words, you know, it just makes me feel peaceful. You know, just the idea of that realization. So what Pastor writes, as we think about this, is, I'm right with God. Though my life is not perfect, He has also given me perfection. Okay? That's a sure promise. I am not at war with God. He is no longer angry at me. The righteousness I wear is His Son's, but He made it my own. I am whole, I am sound, I am healthy, I am content, come what may. Okay? I'm starting to realize why Pastor Carr's sermons are so good. This is stuff he just types off the top of his head. I don't think he revises this at all. And it's all great. You know, so now we've come to the end of peace, and we have to say, well, where does it go? Right? Do we have room for it someplace?
I think it arches over the whole thing.
Yeah, I do too. I think the umbrella.
Okay. And peace, which looks like Pierce, which would be totally wrong, wouldn't it? Anyway. Okay. Peace overarches the whole thing. Peace is what we gain as a result of understanding this to the extent that we can. And, you know, I'm not sure we can understand it all, but peace is what we gain from this. Now, it's also interesting. If God's whole effort is to provide for us peace, confidence, quietness, a respite from fear and so forth. What is Satan's purpose?
Disrupt.
Opposite. The opposite. Disorder, anger, chaos. And I think there's something else about being at peace, which is not mentioned in our verses, but there's something about the idea of selfishness, right? When you're at peace, you don't have to think of yourself all the time. You're free to think of others, right? When you're in a dangerous situation, you know, it's every man for himself. It's that selfishness. So Satan is about all of the opposites of this. And they're always around us all the time. And God is about peace, and God is about creating a system, if you want to call it that, through which we can achieve it. Do we have any final comments before we go to the evaluation forms? Other ideas?
I'll just say I really enjoyed this course.
Thank you. I'm glad.
Very.
Well, I feel like the luckiest of all, because we all know, teachers are the ones who learn, okay? Because they have to stay 30 seconds ahead of whatever's going on. You know?
Well, I think you did an incredible job.
Thank you.
Are you going to be teaching next?
Next quarter? I will be teaching again in winter quarter, I believe.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm scheduled for. And I think, I don't know. Pastor and I need to work on the next course in this, because this is only the first part of it. There's another 12 words or another 13 words that we're going to be adding in.
Cool. So it's just going to keep getting bigger.
No. Absolutely not. We're going to start over again.
Does everyone know?
Well, in that case, does everyone have an evaluation form? They were right over here.
No.
Okay. Well, let's take a few minutes, and we will wrap up early today. Okay.
Now, this question, how well did the teacher manage the class? I'm unruly.
No, that's other classes.
Those are my classes at school, okay?
Right.
No, is it?